Well, we are continuing our time in the Proverbs, and so if you would, open your Bible to Proverbs 25. I'll get back there in a few minutes, but it gives you some time to get to Proverbs 25. After you get through the first 9 chapters of Proverbs, the book loses a tight structure, and so it becomes aphoristic. It's a collection of sayings, individual little sayings, and so we'll bounce around a fair bit. I've tried to find ones that are located for us to look at them with our eyes. But first, we'll be talking about the topic of friendship, and maybe to expand that, of just community and relationship. So I don't know if you knew this, but in recent years and decades, it's been proven that babies in the womb during the third trimester can hear and recognize their mother's voice. And so when that baby is born, it becomes a critical element that mother speaks to baby to calm the baby down. By about 2 months of age, the infant is reciprocating smiles. They're already entering into relationship. We have a couple moms with babies getting to that stage right now, and it is an incredible thing to look at an infant and see them return that response. Well, friends, that's the beginning of a relationship. And secular developmental psychologists, so those who study the development of humans, have come to say that the face is the public theater of the mind, even for infants. As it turns out, still or sad faces can cause a baby to be distressed. But smiling faces, they say infants bask in their parents' smiles. Isn't that a fascinating thing? Even secular science has come to see what we would say is that we were created for relationship. One theologian's put it this way: immediate, face-to-face human interaction is integral to our humanity. As earthly persons, we are accountable not only to God, but also to other human beings. This web of interpersonal relationships draws us into full responsibility and personhood, and it holds us. You see, we need the help, comfort, encouragement, camaraderie, correction, connection, counsel of family, neighbors, and friends. We need babies. Well, we need relationship. And maybe you've been visiting with us this morning, and perhaps you are not a Christian. I think that even this fact that secular science has come to show us our need for relationship is a fascinating thing to think about. So if you would join with me in just a little bit of a thought experiment for a moment. Because the Proverbs doesn't tell us how relationship began, it just tells us how relationship is to go and how friendship is to work. And so again, if you're with us and maybe you're not a Christian, I wonder if you've really thought about this. Where does friendship, altruistic, life-giving friendship, come from a secular, naturalistic worldview? You see, here's the thing. Some theories will say that in the world of hunter-gatherers before us, you had to have some level of friendship because, you know, more hunters is more opportunity for work. But what happens when there's only enough kill to feed your family? Well, friendships tend to disappear, do they not? And I don't know about you, but I've read a fair bit of these things, and I have yet to find a convincing argument from a naturalistic worldview which explains the root of friendship, particularly altruistic, life-giving friendship. So see, for instance, to summarize the argument so far is, even secular science has shown us we need friendship. We're born with that need. Our lives begin that way, and yet I have yet to find an argument where modern science has come to be able to explain why it is that one person would so willingly love another person that's not their offspring that they might even give their lives for that person. Well, I would argue from the Bible that friendship began not on earth, but in heaven. See, I don't know if you caught it this morning, but both Tim and I prayed Trinitarian prayers, which means we recognize that from eternity past, there was Father and Son and Spirit in perfect relationship, in perfect friendship. That is the font of all relationship, of all friendship. Because for eternity past, the Father loved and doted on the Son, and the Son reflected the glory and love of the Father, and the Spirit bound them together, as it's been said, the breath of love between the Father and Son. So see, friends, I'd say from a Christian worldview, we are able to root and ground what now science is showing us is a need, a biological need for friendship in our creation account. But maybe if you're visiting and you're not a Christian, I would just say, have you thought through that carefully? And if you haven't, I would love to offer to do so with you, whether that's read some books together or what have you. But I would love to help you to think through this because we have a need. And friends, I would just say is there's only one worldview that can actually give us what we need to ground those things. So that's how friendship began, I'd argue. What the Proverbs give us is how friendship operates. But what might be surprising to you is that the Proverbs says a great deal about the challenge of friendship, which will be our first point, the challenge of friendship. If you're there in Proverbs 25, let's look at verse 17. It says, "Seldom set foot in your neighbor's house. Too much of you, and they will hate you." The Proverbs doesn't mince words. The Proverbs says friendship is hard. This is one of many verses that we'll consider. Because of this warning of having short visits, I was trying to be wise, and I had a short visit with a friend earlier this week and was talking about this sermon, and he said, "It reminds me of the old W.C. Fields modern proverbs, guests are like fish. After 3 days, they stink." Now remember, proverbs are not universally true. The proverbs require wisdom to apply them. So I'm sure some of you might even say you have certain friends that you don't wear of their company. But I think what the proverb is saying is most of the time, given enough time, maybe a lot longer than 3 days, but that friend constantly being around will start to stink a little bit like fish. And friends, one reason for this is because the longer you're with someone, the longer a friendship goes on, the less and less we cover up. The more our little social awkwardnesses come out, the more we remove our masks. See, if you're in your neighbor's house for long enough, or longer and longer periods, eventually they'll see the real you. Now, with a spouse, they're going to eventually see that. But that's why they've covenanted to be with you, so they can't just take you out like dirty fish. No, they've decided to love you through thick and thin, right, in sickness and in health. But friend, given enough time, our friendship with each other will reveal us, as the saying says, warts and all. And that's what the Proverbs is getting at. In time, those niceties that we put on will fade. Now, I'm someone personally who I strive to be a what you see is what you get kind of guy. I'm that kind of by nature, and I also strive to be that way. But even though I naturally lean that direction, those who get to know me really, really well will see the little rough edges. Ask the elders. They'll tell you. They've been with me enough to see, oh, yes, there are some of his weaknesses and those things. If you don't believe them, ask my wife. She'll tell you more. But after a while, I can be like the three-day-old fish that needs to be taken out. Well, we'll come back to how friends work through these things. But friends, we add to the fact that not only do we just slowly take off our masks, but friends, we also all have expectations. Whether you know it or not, you have all sorts of things that you just expect. You believe this is normal. And you believe that anybody who does it different is weird or maybe dangerous and awful. Let me give you a real-life example of this. You see, there was a young married couple when early in my pastoral ministry, and they were a young couple, and they both of them were pastor's kids. You know, they were like those kids, they probably never really rebelled in any significant way in their life. They were just these sweet kids. And they got married, and they were just like this sweet little 18-year-old married couple. And 6 or so weeks into their marriage, this blow-up of a fight happens. And they're coming and seeking counsel. Well, this is what the fight was over. You ready for this? In her family, the dad always took out the trash because it was his way of protecting the mom from having to deal with gross trash. Well, in his family, the dad worked 2 jobs. And so he didn't do anything at the house because he was doing 2 jobs. Now, here's the thing, folks. In pre-marriage counseling, until that, I had never asked anybody what their family habit of taking out the trash was. Now I ask every single time. Because here's the thing. Something as silly as that expectation created this massive fight. And it was a fight that just drug on. Because it was like, well, no, you will take out the trash because that's the normal way that people do it. See, friends, we all have expectations. So friendship is hard because, first of all, how our sinful hearts attribute motives to other people's expectations? Because our sinful hearts, you know, even when we try not to, still have masks that we put on. Friendship is hard, first and foremost, because we're a bunch of sinners. Turn to Proverbs 20, verse 6. It's on page 525 if you're using the Pew Bible. Proverbs 20, verse 6. Many claim to have unfailing love, but a faithful person, who can find? You see, the Proverbs is not pulling punches. It is speaking to the genuine challenge of the fact that truly faithful person, faithful friend is difficult. There is a want, there's a lack of good friends. If you probably turn back a page, Proverbs 19:4. Wealth attracts many friends, but even the closest friend of the poor person deserts them. And then two verses later, verse 19:6-7. Many curry favor with a ruler, and everyone is the friend of the one who gives gifts. The poor are shunned by all their relatives. How much more do their friends avoid them? Though the poor pursue them with pleading, they are nowhere to be found. You see, in these Proverbs, we get this idea that everyone wants to be around the successful, the powerful, those people that make you feel good about them. And then there's some of those people who are successful and powerful who love to have people around them that make them feel good about themselves. That's a wonderful relationship until there's no longer a need. You see, unbalanced friendship is a reality. This is why Proverbs 26:18-19 says this, like a maniac shooting a flaming arrows of death is one who deceives his neighbor and then says, I was only joking. If you've ever been around or been a middle schooler, you've done that. You've pushed a joke a little too far, and when you saw that it cut to the quick, you had to say, oh, I was just joking. Well, Proverbs says, the friends, given the nature of friendship, we're going to have many failures. We ourselves are going to fall short of caring for others, and others are going to fall short of caring for us. Now, for some, perhaps your natural tendency is toward introversion, which creates one set of problems. The idea of starting up a conversation with someone is hard enough as it is. But then you add to that the fact that maybe you've been hurt in the past, making it even more difficult to seek to engage someone as a friend. A treasure friend maybe let you down. And we can easily identify with the fact that we live in a world that seems to be eternally pushing busyness and doing more. So given the pace of life, who has time to invest in friends? And yet the Word, and even science tells us, we need bosom friends, to use Anne of Green Gables language. You see, our social media world has tried to balm this by saying the average person on Facebook has 500 friends. Liars. There's 500 people that maybe you got connected to because you thought it made you feel good. No, we need true friends. And then add to this, one more challenge is, last week Jeff talked about the prosperity gospel. Well, there's also a softer side to that prosperity gospel. I gave a book out recently that talked about this. And that pastor talks about the Instagramification of Christianity. Here's the point. It's in the world of social media, you're always putting forward the best you, the beautiful you, the happy you. Maybe you have or have been that friend at times where you tend to only share the good things. Your prayer requests are typically about somebody else, not about your own foibles and failures and sins and sorrows. We can fall victim to that too, of putting on a front instead of being a true friend. And then for others, the combination of being a good friend and having a friend that's hard to find mean that people look for companionship in all the wrong places. One of the most horrifying stories I've read in recent years was about a trend that is growing around the world about people using life-size dolls for companionship, putting them in wheelchairs and wheeling them on dates, and sometimes this becomes, quote-unquote, romantic companionship. It just shows us the friendship gap will continue to grow. And yet, Proverbs 21:10 warns, the soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no mercy in his eyes. And someone looks to profit off of sad, sorry, lonely people with plastic friends. Have I depressed you yet? Friends, I want you to feel the weight of the Proverbs warning us that friendship is challenging dangerous business. Doesn't mean we don't need it, but it means the Proverbs is real, very real. So we've seen the challenge of friendship, but thankfully the Proverbs doesn't stop there. It also goes on to speak of how to be a friend. Now, an Old Testament scholar, the late Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner, has done yeoman's work of going through all the Proverbs that talk about neighbor or friend and categorizing them into four buckets. So if you're a note taker, here's the four buckets of you might call these the virtues of being a good friend or the attributes of being a good friend. It's this constancy, candor, counsel, and tact. And I read those to Jeff. He complained that he couldn't find a fourth C, and I didn't try, because Kidner's pretty good. So one more time, constancy, candor, counsel, and tact. We'll work through these together. This is how Proverbs speaks of us learning to be a good friends. First, there's many Proverbs which speak of fair-weather friends, as we've seen. Well, the result or the answer for that failure is constancy. You see, constancy means that we're not merely there to be glommed onto somebody wealthy and attractive or powerful. No, a constant friend is there through thick and thin, through the ups and downs of life. The good friend will be the one who is there no matter what comes around the corner. So Proverbs 27:10 reads, "Do not forsake your friend or a friend of your family, and do not go to your relative's house when disaster strikes. Better a neighbor nearby than a relative far away." What the proverb is saying is, you want a friend who's so constant that you'd rather go to them because they're closer than your family when they're far away, because that friend is constant. And no matter what the sorrow comes, they are there. Similarly, Proverbs 17:9 says, "Whoever covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates close friends." See, the idea of constancy is that even when this person wounds me and hurts me, that they fail to be a friend to me, I would respond in constancy, in loving that person through it all, in letting love cover a multitude of sins. Constancy means we're committed to our relationship even when, again, the masks fade and the rough edges come out. See, so lacking is this virtue of constancy in our modern world that we've invented a word for people with lacking constancy. It's called ghosting. Have you heard of this term? When a friend ghosts you, they've abandoned you like a ghost. They've disappeared. The Proverbs would call us to be those who are constant. And the New Testament picks up this theme for us in many ways. And 1 Peter 4:8 says this, "Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, ongoing, since love covers a multitude of sins." The constant friend will walk and walk out forgiveness. Likewise, 1 John, one of the major themes of the book of 1 John is that we love God and love each other. So sharp does John put this in 1 John 2:9-11. He says, "Whoever says he is in the light and hates his brother is still in darkness. Whoever loves his brother abides in the light, and in him there is no cause for stumbling. But whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he's going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes." You see, we could multiply examples, but the New Testament is crystal clear. The church is to be a place set apart where people build relationships of constancy, that we stand together. So members of Bethany, would we be those who, when wounded, when offended, we remain constant? Would we be those who recognize the fact that if we are members of one body and we're all sinful members of one body, we're going to sin against each other. We're going to step on each other's toes. We're going to poke each other in the eye. Constancy says we overcome with forgiveness, with patience, with remaining. So friend, how are there ways that you are seeking to remain constant? What about those expectations? Here's the beautiful thing about being in a local church is the longer you're here, the more you realize you have expectations that differ from other people. And one of the best ways to grow is to spend time with people whose expectations are different. Learn, ask questions. Maybe you realize you have certain prejudices that certain things have to be done this way, when in fact, maybe they don't have to be done that way. Well, constancy. Second, true friends are those of candor. Turn to Proverbs 27, verse 5. Proverbs 27, verse 5, page 533 in the Pew Bibles. Proverbs 27, 5 and 6. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. Next, look down at verse 17. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. And in this same vein, Proverbs 29, 5 will go on to say, a man who flatters his friend spreads a net for his feet. Keep your finger there in Proverbs 27, because we'll be back. But friends, a true friend is one of candor. A true friend cares far more about your growth in grace than your comfort in your sin. They care far more about you pressing on to win the prize, as Paul will put it, than about coddling you. See, a true friend is more concerned with the state of your heart than with your comfort. So perhaps to put this point as candidly as possible, friend, if you don't have a friend who calls out sin in your life, you may not have a true friend. And one of the reasons you may not have that true friend is because you may have closed the door to those types of friends. Perhaps you have shut them out and refused to give them access to speak candidly to you. Oh, chances are you haven't explicitly said that you refuse to be corrected. But there's a modern proverb that says, once bitten, twice shy. Maybe you have that twice shy mentality. So friend, how do you respond when someone is candid with you and correcting you? If you respond with fangs, don't be surprised if they don't come back again, and you've lost a true friend at that point. Well, another way we shut ourselves off to true friends being candid with us is by never being transparent. It's that Instagramification thing, avoiding real talk, avoiding conversations and prayer requests which are real about sin and suffering in our life. If our prayer requests are always for someone else out there, are we being as transparent as we need to be for that person to be candid with us? I've said before, Proverbs 27, 17 is one of my favorites, iron sharpening iron, because it's oftentimes just quoted but not thought through. For iron to sharpen iron, there is contact, there is friction, there's heat. That doesn't have to be abusive or sinful, but candor is required, and it requires contact. A Christian who avoids all hard conversations is likely a Christian who is not growing because they're not dealing with sin. See, discussing sin and weakness and failure is never comfortable or fun, and we're always going to tend to recoil and bounce back away from it. But if you have friends who love you enough to keep coming after you lovingly, that's a good friend. Third, a good friend is one who has good counsel. So there in Proverbs 27, verse 9, perfume and incense bring joy to the heart, and the pleasantness of a friend springs from their heartfelt advice. I imagine if you're someone who has a friend who is a good counselor, you can even see them now. You can think of them. That person has always counseled me well. Now, being a friend of good counsel does not mean you always have something to say. The best friends, the best time that the friends were with Job was the first week when they just sat there and shut up. Sometimes good counsel is in silent mourning with those who are suffering. But that's why constancy and counsel are two sides of one coin. Sometimes the best counsel is just a constant presence through sorrows and trials. But counsel is also sometimes necessarily verbal. It requires words. And I'll just tell you, as a pastor, the appointments that always cause me the most angst are the times when someone calls for counsel in the middle of a week where my schedule or my busyness has caused me to just not be in the Word like I need to be. Where my time in the Word has been fits and starts or interruptions because I don't have much to give out. See, friends, a true friend's counsel is to dive down into the water of life and draw a bucket up for a friend. So in order for us to be good friends who give good counsel, we must be those who are drinking deeply of the water of the Word of life. And that's why part of the Christian calling is to press on in the Word. to keep digging in, to keep reading and studying. There's no arriving on this journey. That's why it's often called the Christian walk. A walk is just something you do actively. It's only at the end of the walk that you sit down. It's not called the Christian walk and sit. It's the Christian walk, this constant movement, this constant drawing of the water of life, that we might be able to do those who counsel others. So we have constancy, we have candor, we have counsel, and then we have tact. There in Proverbs 27:14, we understand the meaning of and the necessity of tact. If anyone loudly blesses their neighbor early in the morning, it will be taken as a curse. Well, see, this is the other side of candor. Just as candor has the willingness to tell the truth, tact seeks to tell the truth in a way that is disarming. A loud blessing may be required, but tact knows when loud is not going to make that blessing anything other than a curse. So see, whereas candor seeks to rightly address someone's sin, tact seeks to do so in a way that causes them to respond as gently as possible. There are times when my wife is masterful at this, when she gently asks me a question, and I just deflate on the couch. Yeah, I'm having a bad attitude today. And I got my wife's permission to say this. I say there are times she's good at that. There are other times when she takes after her husband, when she's all candor and no tact. In those moments, she sounds like Proverbs 27:15-16. A quarrelsome wife is like a dripping of a leaky roof in a rainstorm. Restraining her is like restraining the wind or grasping oil with the hand. Now, I got her permission to say that, and I read that proverb for two reasons. One, I don't know how you read it and not both cringe and laugh. But secondarily, remember the proverbs were written by the king and queen to their son. It's not a woman-hating book. Men can oftentimes be just as quarrelsome and dripping. And as I said, this is an area where I fail at. Candor comes more easily to me, and I can lack tact. And when I lack tact, I, guess what, sound an awful lot like a dripping roof in a rainstorm. So friends, which one of the four are strengths for you? Constancy, candor, counsel, and tact. Which are the ones that you naturally tend to do well at? And then which are the ones that you struggle, where you need to grow? You see, we are all pilgrims on the way. We are all those growing slowly, stumbling towards Jesus, and we need friends who will strengthen us in those other areas where we are weak. I need friends who tactfully tell me when I'm being tactless. Some of you might need friends who are constant. Others might need friends who are good counselors. The point is, it's a helpful grid for coming and seeing the different ways in which we each fall short, in the ways that another friend might make up for what we are lacking. Well, that's how to be a friend. Last, we have the need, or the friend we need. Turn to Proverbs 17:17. That's on page 525 if you're using the Pew Bibles. The friend we need. Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for a time of adversity. In wisdom literature and poetic literature, there's a parallelism. So you can see brother and friend are parallel, just as adversity in all times are in parallel. So I don't believe the point of the proverb is to say friends are great, but you really need a brother. Rather, what it's showing is that we all need a friend who is as close to us as a brother who came from the same womb. And we need that at all times, but especially in times of trial, especially in times of adversity. See, as you wrestle with our need for friends, if you aggregate all the wisdom of the Proverbs and then of the Scriptures, we learn that we need actually more than just one friend, though. We need close friends with a plural. Derek Kidner writes, Proverbs is emphatic on this point when you look at all the Proverbs on friends, that a few close friends are better than a host of acquaintances. And even in Jesus' life, you can think this through. There's 120 disciples, close disciples, in the upper room on the night of Pentecost, or morning. And then there was 70 disciples who he sent out. But there were 12 that were his inner circle, and even among the 12, there was the three that were the really close friends. Now, it's also true that there was the beloved disciple. Maybe that's just John, you know, trying to make himself feel good. No, it's inspired. But what you see is there's circles of friendship. And part of the important thing the Proverbs shows us and the Bible is that we need to actually have some friends that we share with other friends. And one of the persons who's explained this the best is C.S. Lewis in his book, The Four Loves. And in that book, what he talks about is the fact that why we need mutual friends is to draw out the fullness of that other person. He tells the story of how his friend Charles had died. And he said, contrary to what you'd expect, he didn't have more of Ronald. He actually had less of him. Here's the way Lewis puts it. He says, in each of my friends is something that only some other friend can fully bring out. By myself, I'm not large enough to call the whole man into activity. I want other lights than my own to show all of the facets of this friend. He said, now that Charles is dead, I shall never again see Ronald's reaction to a specifically Caroline joke. Far from having more of Ronald, having Ronald to myself, now that Charles is away, I actually have less Ronald. Hence, true friendship is the least jealous of loves. Two friends delight to be joined by a third, and a third by a fourth, as long as the newcomer is qualified to really become a great friend. So see, while friendship is necessary, the goal in life, in the Christian life in particular, is to try and expand from 2 to 3 to 4. I'm picking numbers. But you want friends who are going to draw out different aspects, different strengths. This is why the New Testament speaks so much about how our sanctification is inseparable from the local church. There's no such thing as an individual Christian being sanctified. Now, that's a bold statement, but I'd be willing to show you from multiple passages. Here's just one, Colossians 3, 14 through 17. Above all, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body. And be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. Friend, every one of those yous is the Greek southern, y'all. It's y'all. Y'all need to let the peace of Christ rule in y'all's hearts. There's no such thing as Lone Ranger Christians who are sanctified in their own little corner. We need friends, Christian friends, who will draw us out. Oh, of course, two people can admonish each other, but sometimes a third comes along and really helps. And in the local church, one of the most important things we do is actually sing to each other. I don't know about you. There's probably some rock stars in the car here, maybe. Some shower singers in this group, I imagine. You're all too ashamed to put up your hand. But you know it's true of you. But how much more boldly are we able to sing in this room? The scriptures actually speak about us singing to one another. I don't know if you caught that, but that's what Colossians says. Ephesians 5 says the same thing. Our relationship, even our singing and worship, is done to one another. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another. By what means? By the means of singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs to each other. Our friendship should be like a song that we sing together. See, instead of hoarding certain friends for ourselves, we look to expand. And one of the best ways we seek to grow in our blind spots is by having one more friend who's a little different, who thinks differently than us, has different expectations than we do. And see, each week in a local church, we gather from people of very different backgrounds. I mean, there's scores of different backgrounds and life stories sitting in this room. One of the best ways we grow is by finding somebody else who sings a little different tune than we do, because they've had different experiences, and sit down with them and find a third who has a little different experience still, and let each other draw each other out. So again, practically, for the introverts among us, Maybe the most important thing you need in your life is to find a Charles or Charlene who will draw you into a group of three or four. Charles or Charlene there is the extrovert drawing you in. But extroverts, be warned, sometimes your drawing sounds like a dripping faucet too. And for the extroverts, you're helping drawing other people's out. Be careful that you do so with tact and candor. See, in local churches, we learn to bear one another's burdens. And in one way or another, introversion and extroversion are different kinds of burdens. They're blessings, but they're burdens. They can be hindrances. So we walk together. Some extroverts can't shut up if their life depended on it. They need an introverted friend who's going to force them to slow down because that introvert is going to just stop and think about everything. And likewise, introverts need to be drawn out. This is how we bear one another's burdens, how we sing to one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. This is why Lewis will go on to explain how friendship is kind of a glorious nearness by resemblance to heaven. Here's what he's talking about. He says this: friendship exhibits a glorious nearness in resemblance to heaven itself, where the multitude of the blessed increase the fruition which each has of God. And that is why the seraphim in Isaiah's vision sing to each other, "Holy, holy, holy." And the one sings to the other, "Holy, holy, holy." Singing the glories of God to your friend to encourage them and build them up. Well, we've looked at human friendship primarily thus far, but we also need to consider friendship with God. Earlier, Tim talked for us or read for us from John 15:15, where Jesus said, "No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you." Do you see the relationship between those phrases? Jesus calls them friends because everything the Father's given him, he gives to them. A true friend is one who's singing the holies about God to another friend. And likewise, if you flip the page, and if you're still here in Proverbs, or go to Proverbs 18, verse 24. Proverbs 18, 24, we read, "One who has unreliable friends soon comes to ruin, but there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother." You see, if it was up to us alone to be the kind of reliable friend we need, we'd be hopeless. If the only friendship in this world had to offer was human, it would be a disaster because we're going to let each other down. We're going to fail each other. If we're remotely honest with ourselves, we fail our closest friends. We default to too much or not enough candor, too much or too little counsel. We let introversion or extroversion rule our interactions rather than a self-sacrificial love which seeks the best of our neighbor and seeks to point them to God. Now, the friend we really need is one who lays down his life for us, as we read about in the story of Jesus. You see, in Jesus, we find perfect constancy because he stood in the Garden of Gethsemane praying that the cup of judgment could pass, and yet he remained constant to God's will. And in Jesus, we find perfect candor because he says clearly, "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me." Jesus speaks hard words. And Jesus has perfect counsel, though, as well, knowing what people need when he said in Matthew 11:28-30, "Come to me, all you who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." See, friends, finally, Jesus is the true friend we need, because he's the perfect balance of all the attributes of friendship. Shortly after that, in Matthew, again, it goes on to say that Jesus is the kind of friend who a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench, until he brings justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will hope. Friends, he calls us to himself in weakness. Jesus' call to friendship is not clean yourself up, it's not fix yourself, it's not knock off your rough edges, it's not go get sanctified in a corner and come to me. He just calls, "Come to me. Turn from sin, repent, and trust in him. Trust in him in seasons when building friends and friendships is challenging. Trust him when human relationships fail. Because Jesus is the friend who loves at all times. He's the brother born for a time of adversity. So as we draw near to him, may we also draw near to each other and grow in our friendliness. Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. And we thank you for the fact that Jesus is the perfect friend that we need. That though we often fail in many ways, that he remains faithful and true. But would you also grow us in our ability to love and care for each other, to grow in our friendships, to grow in constancy, candor, counsel, and tact, all because of what he has done to buy for us the reality that we have all been called friends of God. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.